We're going to call the meeting to order. Martha, would you please call the roll?
Chair Schenck.
Here.
Representatives Artillis.
Here.
Broder.
Here.
Cruz.
Here.
Fullwood, excused. Diaz.
Here.
Gates. Gibbons.
Here.
Holder.
Here.
Ingram. McBurney.
Here.
Peters.
Here.
Porter.
Here.
Richardson.
Here.
Stafford.
Here.
Waldman.
Here.
Workman.
Here.
Young.
Here.
Thank you, Martha. All right, members, today we are going to have a presentation from our staff director, Michelle, on Indian gaming in the state of Florida. And so with that, as soon as she walks to the podium, the floor is hers. And members, I would ask if during the presentation, if you have questions, just get my attention, and you'll be recognized. Okay, Michelle, with that, take it away.
Good afternoon, members. Let's see. Try to be loud. All right, so what I'm hoping to do is give you kind of a basic overview of Indian gaming, well, really Indian law in general, enough to give you a good concept or context to understand the compact, and then we'll go through an overview of what the compact has in it. So basically, underpinning this whole area is this idea of sovereignty. It's the powers of the tribe, the state, and the federal government, and the interplay between them. Tribal sovereignty is inherent in the tribes, predates the United States. And the U.S. Supreme Court has found that it includes the power to regulate internal and social relations, sovereign immunity from suits, and the power to prescribe and enforce laws within their community and their members. But of course, sovereignty, really what matters more is who recognizes your sovereignty. So for the, in the United States, in order for tribes to have the sovereignty, they have to be federally recognized. And there's several avenues for that. There, you can do it by through the courts, Congress, administrative process, and historically by treaty. Nowadays, it's mostly this administrative process. It's a formal recognition. And once the tribe is recognized, it formalizes the government-to-government relations. So the tribe becomes a domestic, dependent nation, and the federal government has certain fiduciary duties to the tribe. The effects of this are that the tribe's sovereignty is recognized, the state's authority is limited as to the tribe, and practically speaking, it determines the eligibility for certain federal programs and services. Now, an interesting paradox, all of this is subject to Congress, their plenary power over the tribes. This was developed in early case law, and an early U.S. Supreme Court case explained that the plenary authority over the tribes has been exercised by Congress from the beginning. Power has always been deemed political and not subject to the courts. So it's kind of a squishy idea. It's pretty difficult to understand, in my opinion. But there it is. Now, where's the state fit in? Generally, state law doesn't apply unless Congress says otherwise. In one case that's the most applicable to Florida is Public Law 280. In Public Law 280, certain states were given the express authority to exercise jurisdiction over tribes for mostly criminal matters. Other states had the option to assume jurisdiction, and Florida assumed jurisdiction. This doesn't include the power to regulate or tax, and it's limited to criminal laws that are prohibitory in nature, not regulatory. And that really underpins where Indian gaming law came. There's a chart in the materials. By the way, my outline for my presentation is in the materials for you. Shows the tribes we have in Florida. The Seminole Tribe of Florida, which had that formal federal recognition in 1957, and the Miccosukee Tribe, which got it in 1962. The Porch Band Creek Indians is an Alabama tribe, but they do own a small piece of trust property in Escambia County right on the border. So that's good to keep in mind. So the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. Before this was passed, we were in this state of Florida had Public Law 280, criminal jurisdiction. In 1979, the Seminole Tribe was planning to open a high-stakes bingo hall. Now, Florida law allowed bingo, but limited it to nonprofit organizations and had other limits on prizes, really the play of the game. And what the tribe was planning to do would have been outside of what the law allowed. So the Broward County Sheriff moved to stop the tribe. But the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that the bingo law was regulatory, not criminal, and so couldn't be applied. Soon after, the U.S. Supreme Court followed the same reasoning in a case you may have heard of called Cabazon. And that was a similar set of facts out of California. So this really opened the door in the whole country for tribal gaming that wasn't really regulated by state or federal law. So Congress stepped in 1988 with the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, or you often hear it called IGRA. IGRA provided the framework to regulate these games and also tried to strike a balance between the interests of the state, the tribe, and the federal government. Now, the first thing IGRA did was apply state gambling law to federal or to tribes, regardless of whether it was regulatory, criminal, it applied. However, only the federal government could enforce that. It's all preempted the federal government. There were exceptions for Class 1, 2, and 3 gaming under a compact, which we'll get to what that means. Now, in order for, as I said before, in order for any of this to apply, you have to be a federally recognized tribe. You also have to have your gaming on Indian lands. This is reservation trust lands. And so, for example, the Porch Band Creek Indians that I mentioned, they own the Gretna Paramutual facility. That's not Indian lands, so Florida's laws, general laws apply, not IGRA. Now, Congress also capped this land, so any land acquired after 1988, you can't gamble on, generally. There are exceptions. The most applicable exception for us to look at is the ability of the secretary to determine that it's in the best interest of the tribe to gamble on this new land. It's not detrimental to the community. Now, the secretary would have to consider or consult with state, local officials, nearby tribes, and even if they made this determination, in order for it to become effective, the governor of the state would have to concur in that decision. So you may have heard recently in the news last summer, the Secretary of Interior took land where Miccosukee Golf and Country Club into trust for the Miccosukee tribe. Now, there's been no indication they're planning to open a casino, but there's some local concerns that they might. In order for that to happen, the Secretary would have to look at the situation and say, it's in the Miccosukee's best interest to have this, and it's not detrimental to the community. Even then, the governor would have to agree with that determination. So we know where we are and who we're playing with, the games. You've probably heard about these classes. This is all a product of IGRA, but it's kind of been, this language has been picked up in other areas. So you've got Class 1 games, which are the social or traditional games, usually tied to ceremonies, celebrations. Prizes are minimal value. State and federal government have no involvement here. It's completely up to the tribes. Class 2 is bingo and bingo-style games and non-bank card games. Now, for these games, if the state allows the game for any purpose, for any person, the tribe can offer that game. There's some federal involvement, but there's no real state involvement, except for the fact that for non-bank card games, state regulations kind of apply. So, for instance, before the state allowed high-stakes no-limit poker, the tribe couldn't have no-limit poker. They had poker, but they couldn't do the no-limit. Now we have no-limit poker, they have no-limit poker. Class 3 games is everything else, your paramutuals, your slot machines, the casinos. The tribe is eligible for these games if, again, the state offers it for any person for any purpose. And that's truly any person, any purpose. So if you have charities allowed to do casino night, the tribe can have casinos or can negotiate for a compact for casinos. The tribe comes to the state, asks for a compact, they enter negotiations, the state has to negotiate in good faith. Once that compact is agreed to, it's approved by the federal government, and it kind of, the compact governs the conduct of the games. Now, one thing that comes up sometimes is the Miccosukee tribe, they don't have a compact. Do they have slot machines? In IGRA, electronic gaming may be Class 2 or Class 3. So the Miccosukee have bingo gaming machines that are Class 2. The difference is that Class 2 machines are technological aids that assist the player in playing the game, whereas Class 3 machines are facsimiles of games that kind of simulate the game, or slot machines. Another way to think about it is Class 2, you're playing against other players for a common prize, whereas Class 3, you're playing against the machine for a payout. Are there any questions on that background, and I'll move into the compact?
All right, members, questions on what we've gone over so far? Yes, sir.
Just one. Do you know if there's anything in federal law that would allow an Indian tribe to expand their land or their territory?
You recognize, Michelle.
There is a process. Again, the Indian land, it's not just what they own. It has to be taken into trust by the federal government. This is what happened with the Miccosukee. The process, I don't have it with me exactly the process, how it goes. I do know that the Secretary of the Interior has the authority to take lands into trust. However, this authority was limited a couple years ago by the Supreme Court to tribes that were under federal jurisdiction in 1934. Now, what that means is not really determined yet. So, like the Miami, like the Miccosukee Golf Course, for instance. Last I heard, Miami-Dade County was challenging that. I would imagine they're challenging it based on the idea that the Miccosukee tribe wasn't recognized in 1934. So it is possible. There's a process for it. You'd have to get that land into trust, and then IGRA has a separate process for can you gamble on that land. Does that make sense?
Other
yes.
Follow-up? Representative, you're recognized.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. So I and we can do some additional work on this. I don't want to put you on the spot with the question, but if somebody wanted to, a tribe wanted to expand, that would be a federal action, or you're saying, I guess, a state or local municipality could challenge it. Is that right?
Michelle?
It's a federal process. But yes, counties have challenged it in the past. There was a recent case where just a nearby property owner challenged it. So the challenges are possible, but it's a federal process.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions, members? Representative Ingram, did you have a question? Thank you. Okay, Michelle.
All right, the compact. Compact has 20-year term, started August 1st, 2010. It'll end July 31st, 2030, assuming it's not renewed. As part of this, there is a 5-year authorization for banked card games. That ends July 31st, 2015. It authorized games include slot machines, raffles, and drawings. These are at all 7 of the tribe's facilities. Banked card games were limited to 5 facilities. The tribe agreed not to offer banked card games at Brighton and Big Cypress casinos. The compact specifically excludes roulette, craps, and similar style games. And if Florida law was amended to authorize any new game for any person, it would automatically be authorized for the tribe as well. They wouldn't have to come renegotiate. Now, the regulation of the games themselves the compact sets up this relationship for the tribe and the state. The tribe regulates the games. The state's role is more of an oversight function to make sure that the tribe is complying with the compact, state or federal law, those sorts of things. And in the materials, kind of outlines the sorts of things that the tribe is regulating and what's specifically referenced in the compact. And the state's role, what they're looking for, and then how they go about it. The compact allows one random inspection per month per facility, but it caps the number of hours. And there's also reviews of audits of the slot machine operation and an independent audit of games annually. The cost of all of this oversight is borne by the tribe. It's capped at $250,000 annually, but the tribe pays that, and that's not part of revenue sharing. Another thing the tribe pays that's not part of revenue sharing is the $250,000 per facility to the Florida Council on Compulsive Gambling for those programs. There's some specific compact provisions that are in the materials, like the provisions on non-smoking areas, minimum slot machine payout, those sorts of things. The compact also includes a revenue sharing agreement. Now, under federal law, remember that states can't tax Indian tribes. And IGRA doesn't specifically talk about revenue sharing. This is something that's kind of developed outside of what Congress did, although there's some evidence that Congress had this in mind. At this point, the Department of Interior looks at two things when he's reviewing revenue sharing agreements. Has the state given some kind of meaningful concession to the tribe? It has to be something of value. And then what is the tribe giving in return? Is it proportional? Now, under our compact, the state granted the Seminole Tribe exclusivity as to banked card games throughout the state and partial geographic exclusivity as to slot machines and other Class 3 style games in exchange for a share of the tribe's revenue. If you were around a few years ago, probably heard and saw all the news articles about the compact. There was a previous compact, and under the previous compact, there were payments that were made. So our current compact says that those payments go to the state. We can get into it if you want to, but basically Governor Chris and the tribe negotiated a compact, signed it. Tribe started operating under that compact, but the Florida Supreme Court ruled the governor didn't have the authority to bind the state to that compact because it allowed games that Florida law didn't allow, banked card games in particular. So the state got $287.5 million from the tribe's operations before this final compact went into effect. On top of that, there's a guaranteed minimum payment of $1 billion over 5 years. This is split up, $150 million per year in the first 2 years, $233 in years 3 and 4, where we are now, and then $234 million in year 5. There are a few scenarios where this guarantee would go away. Most are tied to revenue sharing, but there is one in the case of some event outside of the tribe's control that damaged one of its facilities, reduced their revenues, then the guarantee would be reduced by a proportional share. Beginning in year 3, we have the guarantee, then we start having the revenue sharing formula, percentages. This is where we are now. This just kicked in. So the state share is calculated on a sliding scale depending on the tribe's net win. Net win is defined as total receipts from all the covered games, so it's not going to include poker, for instance, minus the prize payouts and then promotional credits. There's a chart in the materials that goes through, but it's a sliding scale from 12% up to 25% each year if the state gets whichever one is more. So far we've been getting the guaranteed payment. You heard Amy Baker talk about that last time. So, part of the revenue share is that 3% of this total amount the state distributes to local governments. That is in the compact, and then in statute we have the formula for where that money is going. And again, there's a chart in your materials that shows where those percentages are going. It varies by facility. So. All right, so the tribe's giving us all this money. What are they getting? Exclusivity. So the compact granted the tribe partial but substantial exclusivity. And the definition that you want to keep in mind is this Class 3 gaming or any other casino-style gaming. It's more than just Class 3 games. So it includes but not limited to slot machines, electronically assisted bingo, or electronically assisted pool tab games, table games, video lottery terminals, or any similar games, whether or not the games use a random number generator. So very broad. Basically, Class 3 games and any kind of electronic gaming. If the legislature or the people by constitutional amendment amend the law to allow the operation of Class 3 gaming or other style casino-style gaming at any location that wasn't in operation on the date the compact was negotiated, was just February 1st, 2010, or if new games or new forms of gaming are authorized that weren't in operation on that date, revenue sharing ends. That's the general rule. The revenue sharing ends when the new game begins. If the new game ends, or the authorization for the new game ends, then revenue sharing can pick up again. Now, if this change in law comes about by court decision or administrative ruling, the tribe makes their payments into escrow, and then the state or the legislature has a year or until the end of the next session to address the matter. If the state breaches these exclusivity provisions or any of what I'm talking about happens, the compact in general stays in effect. It's only the revenue sharing portion that changes. Now, the compact basically froze Florida's gaming industry on that February 1st, 2010 date. Any expansion beyond what was happening on that date can affect revenue sharing. And the compact specifically provides these exceptions that existed on that date. So slot machines at the existing facilities in Miami-Dade and Broward, parimutuel wagering at licensed facilities, poker at licensed card rooms, lottery games. The compact does put some specific restrictions on the lottery. The lottery can't have player-activated machines except for vending machines. The lottery can't place more than 10 vending machines in any one location, and the lottery can't place vending machines at parimutuel facilities. And it also exempted games authorized by Chapter 849, which is Florida's gambling chapter, other than parimutuels. Again, all of this is as of February 1st, 2010. But there are additional exceptions. So the compact provided some limited circumstances where gambling can be expanded without ending the revenue sharing agreement. Try to simplify this into a chart for you. It depends on where the games are authorized, who the games are authorized for. So additional games at the existing parimutuel facilities in Broward and Miami-Dade would result in, well, if the tribe's net win from those Broward facilities was reduced, then the revenue sharing from the Broward facilities would also be reduced by 50% of whatever that reduction in net win was. If additional games were offered in new locations in Miami-Dade and Broward outside of those parimutuel facilities, then all revenue sharing from those Broward facilities would end. Revenue sharing from the rest of the state would continue. There's provision for compacts with other tribes. There's provisions in the compact for up to 350 historic racing machines and electronic bingo machines at parimutuel facilities outside of Miami-Dade and Broward. These are not the same bingo machines that the Miccosukee have. To the best of my knowledge from conversations in the past, the way the compact describes these machines, they don't really exist. but the possibility is there for the machines to be developed and put into the facilities. That would have no effect on revenue sharing. There's also specific mention of internet gambling. If the state were to authorize it and the tribe didn't also offer it, and the tribe's net win was reduced by 5%, then the guaranteed minimum payment would end. But the revenue sharing based on the formula would still continue. Excuse me. That's the bulk of the compact. Now, if there's some kind of dispute that comes up, the compact includes a whole dispute resolution process. The party complaining serves notice on the other party, and they meet within 30 days to try to work it out between the two of them. If they can't do that, then you move to the next step. If it's a dispute about revenue sharing and the tribe has stopped payments, if they haven't been able to resolve it in those 30 days unless they extend it, then the state can seek injunctive relief in federal or state court to compel those payments. For all other disputes, the parties can go to mediation. Mediation can't last more than 60 days unless the parties extend it, and at that point you move on to the next step, which is judicial resolution. Either party can bring an action in U.S. District Court. District Court refuses jurisdiction, the compact provides it can be brought in the 17th Circuit in Broward. Now, under this dispute resolution, these provisions, both the state and tribe expressly waive their sovereign immunity from disputes arising under the compact and enforcement of any resulting judgments. Now, this waiver is limited to compact issues. There can't be any money damages except for the payments under the compact, and it doesn't apply to third parties. Now, where we are now is that the bank to card game authorization will expire on July 31st, 2015. So the legislature has a few options. The legislature does nothing. The authorization will expire, and then the tribe gets 90 days to stop offering the games. If it doesn't, then the compact provides that the state can immediately seek an injunction to stop those games. If this happens and the games stop, then the revenue share from Broward County also stops. Revenue sharing under the compact will continue. The compact will continue. It's just the percentage will exclude the net win from the tribe's facilities in Broward. The legislature could pass a law to renew the authorization. Everything would continue as it is, unchanged. The legislature could also authorize bank card games for anyone else. If the legislature did this, the tribe would still be able to offer the bank card games, but the effect on revenue sharing would be based on the discussion we just had. Who is offering the games? Where are they? Another option is for the state and tribe to renegotiate the compact. This can be done by amendment or a new compact. Now, in that last experience the state had with this issue, the legislature passed a process for compacts going forward, and the governor is authorized to negotiate on behalf of the state, but the legislature has to ratify any new compacts. Now, neither the compact or state law specifies who would negotiate an amendment to the existing compact on behalf of the state, but based on that statute, it would make some sense for the governor to also negotiate there. But the compact does specifically provide that any amendments to provisions related to cover games, the amount of revenue share, any suspension or reduction in revenue sharing, or any changes to the exclusivity would require legislative ratification. And we know from the Florida Supreme Court's opinion of that first compact that the governor wouldn't have the ability to bind the state to a compact that violated state law. That's it. There's a timeline of the major events at the end of the materials. But any questions?
Okay, members. Questions? Questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Do you know what provisions are in the compact regarding audits on the revenue sharing?
Michelle?
Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes, there's an annual audit. There's also, gets into some technical, I'm not sure how to get to that page, sorry. So the state reviews audits, independent audits that the tribe gets, I believe, is how it works.
Mr. Chair, we can follow up on this question later if it's better.
Yeah,
and the tribe's here too, so they would know, and also the department, and they're the state compliance agency under the compact, so they would know too.
Representative, what I'll make sure happens is we'll get the correct answer and have it distributed to all the members of the committee.
Can I just ask one follow-up?
Sure.
Thank you. I think when we had a presentation by DPR a few weeks ago, someone asked a question about audits, and I think I understood that there have never been any independent audits conducted by the state. I think that there are audits performed by independent, perhaps CPAs, and then the state relies upon those reports. But I would appreciate if we could follow up on that and see if the state has ever actually conducted an audit, and if we have the right to conduct an audit in accordance with the provisions of the compact.
Okay. We will certainly get that information for you.
Thank you.
Other questions, members? Representative Waldman, for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on some of what we also talked about a couple of weeks ago, and that has to do with the revenue and how much it is, because it can't be a secret, because it doesn't make sense, because we have to see the numbers of how much comes and how much we put into the budget. So what are the procedures for us to obtain the actual numbers? Because based upon what we looked at before, it looked like they were close to $2 billion in revenue already, and that was with one of the minimum payments.
Michelle, you recognized.
Right. My understanding is that the department does see those actual numbers, but they don't, they're not public records. My understanding is also that the tribe has been very close to that $2 billion mark, so that's why we've been getting that minimum payment. But no, there's, I think that's an issue that was decided between the department and the tribe, that those figures were confidential, I guess.
Follow-up?
Not subject, yes.
Follow-up?
Sure.
Because they're really not confidential, though, because they actually post them. The tribal news has all those figures. The numbers are out there, and it's the only way we, as a legislative body, though, can determine how much money we're going to have in income from them, because we know if they're over $2 billion, then we're going to be seeing a larger percentage. So I don't understand why everybody's taking that position that it's all private and we don't have those numbers. We have to get them.
Representative Waldman, I would suggest one of the tribes here, maybe they can speak to it after Michelle. Remember, she's just our staff director here to educate us. If there are requests or fact-finding that you would like our staff to do, then certainly she can do that. Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay. All right, then. Michelle, thank you very much for the presentation. I have one appearance card. Barry Richard, representing the Seminole Tribe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, for inviting us to join with you today. I would suspect that in the history of the state of Florida, there has rarely, if ever, been a partnership as successful as this compact partnership has been between the state of Florida and the Seminole Tribe. And I can briefly give you some statistics to give you an idea of why. But let me first tell you that we have an elaborate set of procedures in the event of a dispute for resolution, which we have never needed to use. The tribe meets with the Department of Business and Professional Regulation on a regular basis, at least quarterly. We have never had an issue that we've had any difficulty with. It's been an extraordinarily cooperative endeavor by both the state and the tribe. Thus far, the tribe has paid to the state of Florida in revenue sharing $726 million, which has exceeded the projections that both parties worked with at the time that the compact was initially entered into. The tribe currently, in its gaming operations, employs 10,148 persons statewide, to whom it pays salaries in a total of $366.4 million. The amount of employment by the tribe in its gaming operations has increased 52% since 2008, primarily as a result of card games, which is very labor-intensive. The in-state expenditures by the tribe, direct expenditures, is $381.4 million annually. When you add indirect operations, which includes vendors and others who exist for the purpose of servicing the tribe's interests, and those retail establishments that exist at the tribe's locations, it comes to $1,596 million. In terms of capital expenditures, because the tribe, since the day that it began, has had a continuing operation for the construction of new facilities, the tribe has completed or has underway $354 million in construction activities, $607 million in total impact, and the jobs that are being maintained solely for the purpose of capital improvement are 2,900 jobs. Those persons are earning a total of $137 million. I am often asked, not often, but the question that I am asked most frequently with respect to the compact is regarding the issue of exclusivity. And that issue was explained by Ms. Morton, but to add just a little bit to that explanation, the IGRA itself, the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, provides that there shall be no tax, fee, charge, or other assessment on the tribe in return for the tribe being given the ability to engage in gaming. However, the Department of the Interior, after a few unfortunate states and tribes entered into compacts, unfortunate for the tribes or for the, for those states, the Department of the Interior interpreted that provision to mean that it would be okay for the tribe to share revenue with the state if the tribe received something in consideration for the revenue, so that it was not the right to gamble for which the state was receiving money, but the additional benefit. The only benefit that the Department of the Interior has ever recognized is a degree of exclusivity, and the amount of money that the tribe pays to the state must be approved by the Department of the Interior after a finding that it is commensurate with the amount of exclusivity that the tribe has. And that was an issue that we had to present to the Department of the Interior, both the state and the tribe, in order to get approval, which it did provide. I have one other thing I wanted to mention, but are there any questions with respect to what I've commented on or anything regarding the compact itself?
Questions so far, members, for Mr. Richard? Representative Waldman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Perhaps I can get the answer from you then. The secrecy, it's not my understanding that the numbers were supposed to be secret of what the revenue was, the net wins. We need to have those in order to determine how much money we're to receive. We can back it out, obviously, if we go that way, but what's all this about the secrecy so much?
I think you're asking two different questions. The confidentiality provision exists because of the fact that the tribe, as anybody in any business, has trade secrets with respect to its competition in the industry. It is not secret to the state of Florida. The tribe makes regular reports to the state of Florida on its revenue and its expenditures and all of the numbers, which go to the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. It is audited at least once annually in an independent audit paid for by the tribe. In addition to that, the state has extensive right to inspect the machines, including the amount of revenue that the machines are generating on a machine-by-machine basis. All of that information is available to the tribe, I mean to the state. If you are asking me whether a member of the legislature has access to that information, that is not addressed by the compact. As in many instances, the compact addresses the availability to the executive branch, of the information, which is true, by the way, in a number of industries, including a number of industries that the Department of Business and Professional Regulation regulate. So the answer is it is confidential to the outside world because of the trade secret nature of the information. You are correct that some of that information becomes public, but not the not to the extent that it's provided to the Department of Business and Professional Regulation. All of it, there is nothing relating to the machines, the revenue generated, the expenses, that is not available both through the audit and through any request by the Department of Professional and Business Regulation.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out, I mean, because you know generally how much going to Las Vegas, what the net winnings are of entities, and it's really not a secret, I mean, in terms of what the MMOs are earning throughout the tribal world, because they have all the tribal news and everything is out there in the city. If I just wanted to get to the point where if the tribe is saying we're not contesting the fact that the legislature ought to know how much money we're talking about, because in order for us to go forward and negotiate, we need to know it, and it shouldn't just be two or three people. It should be many.
Well, I can speak to what's in the compact, which I was intimately involved in negotiating. And that's really all I can do. I can't speak to the policy questions or to the tribe's position, nor is it anything I've had occasion to discuss with the tribe.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you. Just to follow up on my earlier question about the audit. So you just mentioned, I believe, that there's an independent audit performed annually. But I don't believe that report that is publicly available. That, as you're saying, that's what's provided to DBPR?
Well, that is provided to DBPR, and in addition to that, DBPR, at any time that they want to, within some limits in terms of time and frequency, can audit any particular machine or any group of machines. And it also has the right to request information from the tribe other than the annual audit.
Follow-up, sir? Mm-hmm. So back to Representative Walden's question about the confidentiality. So the confidentiality agreement would prohibit you from giving me or all of us a copy of that audit?
Well, nothing prohibits the tribe from giving anything to anybody. It entitles the tribe to maintain confidentiality. And as I said, there's nothing in the compact that addresses anything other than the fact that the DBPR is entitled to this information, but that beyond that, it's confidential.
One more.
Sure.
Would you, in your discussions with the tribe, would you ask them if they would like to release that audit to this committee, please, sir?
I would be happy to do that because my memory is not so hot. Perhaps the secretary would pass that on, or the chairman would pass it on to the tribe.
Thank you, sir.
Other questions? Okay.
The only other thing I wanted to mention, Mr. Chairman, is as we all know, there are casino operations worldwide that would love to begin doing business in the state of Florida, and the issue has come up from time to time in legislative sessions. I just wanted to mention to this committee that there is nothing in federal or state law or in this compact that prohibits the tribe, in cooperation with the state, from building additional facilities outside of the tribal lands. In fact, if the tribe enters into an agreement with the state of Florida to build facilities outside of its reservations, it doesn't have the restrictions that currently exist to IGRA. So you could negotiate with the tribe any deal that you could negotiate with any other gaming interest. The difference being that that agreement would not necessarily require the state to give up the revenue that it currently has from the tribe. The tribe is one of the most successful gaming operations in the world. It currently has extraordinary end resorts in Malaysia, Macau, Singapore, the Dominican Republic, Abu Dhabi, Cancun, Panama, and what is a surprise to many people is that the tribe owns worldwide the Hard Rock franchise. So all I'm suggesting to you is, if the legislature truly ever has an appetite to expand gaming in the state of Florida, it would be wise to talk to the tribe first, because they have things to offer that nobody else can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Okay. Anybody else in the public wanting to say anything? Excellent. And that's much appreciated by the members of the committee. Okay. Members, with that, we've come to the close of our presentations today. And if nobody else has anything to say, Representative Porter moves we rise.